Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colin Thubron, whose latest book is To a Mountain in Tibet. Colin Thubron is a travel writer, has written 9 works of nonfiction and 7 novels. To a Mountain in Tibet concerns a journey that begins in Simikot, Nepal, and takes us to Mount Kailash, which is located in Tibet, a long journey through mountains, through the Himalayas. What brought you to Tibet in the first place, and what is the relationship of that to what was happening in your own personal life?
What brought me to Tibet in the first place was a bit unusual. Most of my books have taken place over long periods of time and many thousands of miles. This is a short, charged journey. I didn't even know that it was going to become a book when I started it. And it was caused by the death of my mother, which at my age is nothing very unusual, but my family had gone. My sister was dead. My father was dead. And I can't even make it logical, but I wanted to mark it in some way, to break up the ordinary tenor of my life and to walk somewhere. And years ago, an Indian woman had told me about this mountain, which lay beyond the Himalayas and was of strange sort of beauty and holiness, sacred to one-fifth of humankind. And I thought, well, I think I'll go there. I liked the idea that it wasn't, say, like Jerusalem or Mecca. It wasn't where God was supposed to have walked in history or his prophets. It wasn't associated with any dogma. It was simply, to me at least, this beautiful object sitting out there in the heart of Asia. And I decided to go.
Obviously, as someone who travels a lot, I interviewed you years ago for your book In Siberia, you have a little bit better idea of how to deal with the circumstances. But you're in, I guess, London at the time. Take us to the starting point of the journey, which is where the book begins.
The starting point was this little place called Simikot, which is stuck out in northwest Nepal. There are no roads, nothing. It was an area that was overrun by Maoist guerrillas at one time. But now they've cleared out and were back in Kathmandu trying to become part of government. And so it hadn't been visited very much, although there was a trekker's trail there for quite a while. I simply find myself walking up the valley of the Kanari River, which is the highest source of the Ganges, which has its origins near Mount Kailash over the border in Tibet. I went rather British Raj, like I had a Sherpa and a cook with me, and even a guy with a horse, so we could put our tents on it. It was very lovely. It was very tranquil for much of the way. And then, of course, after 8 or 9 days, we reached the border of Tibet. Then it was more problematic because the Chinese police are there.
What does it require to go through that journey? I mean, obviously you take a plane to New Delhi, and then you take another plane, maybe to Kathmandu, and then a bus, or what?
That's right. You fly probably New Delhi, Kathmandu. Then you fly in little aircraft by stages. And I eventually arrived at Simikot in a twin otter aircraft, one of those funny little things that knows their way through the mountains, and you think they're going to crash. They arrive at this sort of one-horse town. It's from there that you take off on foot. There's no other way to go up towards Tibet.
This is on, I guess, the western side of Tibet, right near the Indian border.
Yeah, that's right. It's a sort of militarized area to some extent, which makes it even more difficult. You had to get permission beforehand. I had an agent in England who had a sub-agent in Kathmandu, and I left that all for them, because it's complicated, it's time-consuming. You have not just to get the ordinary visas for Tibet, which are difficult, but this military visa as well. But once you've got those in place, it was okay.
Had you been to Tibet before?
I'd never been. I'd never thought I particularly wanted to go. I thought it would probably make me angry. I wanted to travel in China a lot. I didn't want to feel angry with the Chinese. It seemed uncreative feelings to have. Tibet hadn't actually interested me terribly until I began looking a bit at Tibetan Buddhism, what it meant, what its traditions were. And a part of the impulse was that, because Tibet in the West is a very death-haunted culture. I think the only Tibetan text anybody's ever read here is the Book of the Dead. We know that they feed their dead to vultures, which seems to us quite grotesque as a way of dying. But these things are kind of troubling and as well as interesting to the Western consciousness. I was going in part almost to test my own desires. I mean, I'm agnostic. I can't say that I have any developed or strongly held beliefs about the afterlife, but the Tibetans do, and I wanted in a way to test my Christian tradition against a culture that was very conscious of death and what it meant. This sounds like it was very programmatic, but actually it was rather illogical. I was just doing something that I wanted to do, which was walk to a holy mountain. I hardly knew anything about Tibetan Buddhism, and it's a very particular tradition. It was my mother's death. You know, I'm old. Myself, she was very old when she died. There's nothing tragic or strange about it, but there's something about the realization that you have no family at all, that you're the end of the line, you have no children, no siblings, that stirred me, that made me want to do something. It sounds crazy, and I can't explain it better than that. That was why I started looking at Tibetan Buddhism, not like a quest. It wasn't as if I was hoping to change myself or be enlightened or anything. It was more as if this journey was going to be one of kind of meditation, time out of my life, time to be thinking about, in a more relaxed way, the past, and even to entertain ideas, at least, about the afterlife. That was 2009. I started in May, and in June, this was the Buddhist holy month of Sagadawa that I was moving towards.
I'm somewhat familiar with Tibetan Buddhism. I'd never heard of Mount Kailash, though.
It's not very well known. I mean, there are tour groups that go to it. Sometimes you can get to it from Lhasa if you sort of sit in a truck for about 4 days. Tibet's always been hard to reach. It's in the 19th century, it was the forbidden land, literally, and you could only enter it by disguise or subterfuge. In the 20th century, it became a little bit more familiar to us, but always had this sort of mystique about it, as if it was unattainable. Even after the flight of the Dalai Lama in 1959, and the Tibetan sort of diaspora into the West, so we became more familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, ironically, now that it was unseated from its homeland. Even after all that, I think Tibet's been this country people have thought of as difficult. And Kailash is hundreds of miles to the west of Lhasa. It's hard to get to, and it's been, until fairly recently, really exclusively the province of Hindu pilgrims who come, as well as the Tibetan Buddhists.
One of the most shocking elements, and you mentioned it earlier on, I'm just curious if you knew about this in advance, is there were hundreds, tens at least, of monasteries along that route, because it's a holy route. There's one left. They were all destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. Did you know this going in?
I assume they would have been. You know, I traveled a lot in China and in distant parts of China, and you can go to the most remote part of China, up in the plateaus of Qinghai or the forests bordering on Laos or somewhere, and you think, well, the Chinese Red Guards won't have come here. Surely this place has escaped. And you find, no, not at all. Everything wiped out. And in Tibet, it's the same. You arrive at this beautiful holy lake of Manasarova. Mount Kailash is shining in the lake beyond. You know that you've read perhaps that there are 6 or 8 monasteries once around this lake, 4 monasteries around Kailash, and every single one was leveled to the dust during the Cultural Revolution in 1966. But they've rebuilt most of them, very poor, just maybe 3 or 4 monks in each one, poor and uneducated seeming monks, but keeping up a little tradition there. It's quite moving. The monasteries look like sort of little collections of huts very often, built of stone, but they're very modest buildings.
Before you entered Tibet, when you were traveling through Nepal, you were entering an area that had not been under the control of the Nepalese government, but actually under the control of the Marxist revolutionaries, which meant even the area before you reach Tibet had been damaged by modern politics.
Yes, but the monasteries, they're sometimes very decayed. The monks were sort of cowed or even chased away sometimes. You could still see the Maoist slogans on the walls of villages faded now.
The path itself, trying to get a sense of the terrain that you're taking. Now, when you start out, do you see the Himalayas rising above you, around you in the distance?
Yes, you're already inside them almost. When you land at Simikot in this funny little aircraft, glad that you're alive, you are already in sort of Himalayan foothills, I would say. And then you walk up this extraordinary valley of the Karnali, full of trees, beautiful trees, hemlocks and fir trees, 150 feet above you. It's a rich-looking valley with actually very poor villages in it. But the Himalayas all around you. These are, one of the great parts of the Himalayan range, Saipal Himal and so on. They're not as well known as those a little to the east, as Annapurna or Everest, but still they're very high. It's a very beautiful journey, but slowly, day by day, the trees start to vanish, then the shrubs vanish, and when you reach the Tibetan plateau, there's nothing. An empty plain in front of you with strange violet tinges of light. These lakes, which are like abstract sculpture carved out of the plateau, a brilliant blue, not a shrub around them, sacred in the case of the Great Lake under Mount Kailash, the highest freshwater lake in the world at 15,000 feet, and it's about 54 miles round. It's rather wonderful in a way. It's like being in desert, except that you're 3 miles above sea level.
It took you some time to accommodate yourself, I know, to altitude sickness. When I was in the Andes about 20 years ago, I recall that, and I also recall being around Puno, and there are no trees there. I mean, it's kind of similar to that area?
A little bit. The Andes are so unusual. You don't get those extraordinary sheer scarps that you do in the Andes so often. Quite terrifying. It's hard to say what the differences are. It's a little bit gentler, and eventually it's more arid, inasmuch as there's no vegetation in sight. And that dark rock that I remember in the Andes is there on Kailash, which is built on a sort of granite base. But in general, the colors are more russet and often sort of mineral colors. And eventually, of course, you're looking back at the Himalayas. They're behind you. And you see this enormous range of snow-capped peaks going on and on and on at the distance. Peaks which eventually are reaching 26,000 feet. I mean, I don't know how many mountains there are 26,000 feet in the world. I think only about 10 or 12, four of them are just off to your east there, where in front of you is this extraordinary empty plain of Tibet. This is Nagari, which is the most, I think, remote and thinly populated area of Tibet.
As you were traveling from Sinakot in, it must have felt on some level as if you were traveling back in time.
Yes, in many ways. You know, this is sort of time travel because the peoples there are so isolated. When you get to Tibet itself, of course, there's always a feeling that Tibet is embalmed in some way. People feel time has stopped there. They always did. They felt that Tibetan Buddhism was a Buddhism which was, latterly at least, it's thought as the pure Buddhism that was somehow enclosed in the Tibetan platform, isolated from any contaminating influence, and this was where the pure Buddhism had been preserved, as if time indeed had stopped there. That was a feeling that we've had it all through the 20th century, I think, that this Buddhism is in some ways the real thing. In earlier centuries, they didn't think that at all. Victorian travelers in Tibet thought this was a sort of decadent leftover of the real Buddhism. And then that all got reversed in the early 20th century, and it's gone on that the West has sort of reposed its fantasies in Tibet. We want them to be wonderful, sort of innocent theocracy of governing monks, a sort of Shangri-La that has an ancient wisdom that may one day come and save us all. All these feelings have gone on Tibet traditionally as if it did belong in another, more innocent era of time.
Did you feel in talking to the various monks that they were actually, I don't know, maybe holier? Or did you feel that the same way you would feel, say, going into a Christian monastery and, you know, you're wondering, are they praying because they're holy, or are they praying because they don't want to be in the world, or what's going on?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's not always easy to know, because a lot of Buddhist monks join or are almost given to their families to the monastery, so that they join almost not of their own choice. And these young acolytes make up a big part of the monastic population. Some of them leave. You know, when adolescence comes, there's trouble. And they begin to getting restless and wondering what they're missing and so on. So you get a very diverse community, particularly in the Tibetan Buddhist communities in Nepal, just over the border. These big monasteries. Yes, I think inevitably you get a feeling that some of them are just sort of going through the motions. But you also get, among the more serious monks, a very austere and concentrated and serious system of meditation, which is peculiar to the Tibetan Buddhism. They call it Vajrayana, the Diamond Vehicle, because they believe that in a single lifetime, which is a scandalously short time to conventional Buddhists, you can overleap all the cycles of reincarnation that, in their belief, await us all almost into eternity. You can overleap the whole lot and enter nirvana, enter paradise, by a concentrated discipline, really. They call it a discipline or science of meditation.
About a year ago, I was in Chiang Mai in Thailand, and I talked to a lot of monks there, which was a fascinating experience. They're mostly students, mostly Laotian students, who that's the only way they could learn, and many of them, of course, eventually leave the monkhood. Are we talking difference in terms of some small issues, or is Tibetan Buddhism, at least as practiced on that plateau that you saw, so different that it's as if you're looking at two entirely different religions?
I don't know enough to be really sure of that. The Southeast Asian tradition, the Thailand tradition and so on, is the Hinayana Buddhism, as they say. They're more scriptural. The Mahayana, which is part of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, would say that they're more broad-minded, flexible, able to take in all sorts of other traditions and ideas. I think what you're mainly looking at, outside the ordinary practice of the average illiterate pilgrim who is going around Mount Kailash, who are basically often looking for practical benefits that will accrue to them from this devotional exercise. Apart from that, I think the tradition, the meditative tradition that the Buddhists have in Tibet is peculiar to themselves. This is their tradition. It involves a lot of work, often with mandalas, these sacred pictures on which the meditating adept concentrates in order to bring his mind into a new realization, as they call it. The belief is, of course, that the world is illusory, and that you come to this realization that all things are one rather than separate through this intense concentration, often with a mandala, with mantras, and above all with a teacher. It's a tradition in which they are taught by a senior monk, and this goes to a junior one who then becomes a teacher himself. And this is the tradition which the Chinese invasion has threatened so much, that passing on of knowledge from teacher to pupil. And that is arguably flourishing better in the diaspora where Tibetan Buddhism has taken root, like northern India in parts, or parts of Nepal.
And even here in California.
Yes, here you wonder in California, because Tibetan Buddhists can slightly despise the... They say, you know, they're doing it, the Americans doing it for therapy. They're just doing it to make themselves feel better. And it's not serious. If they were serious, you know, they would be concentrating 24 hours a day, or at least 4 hours a day, like the Dalai Lama. They can be a little bit bewildered by the American tradition as it's become. But I know that there are all sorts of teachers in the States. Some of them are good.
Okay, you're traveling, and you finally reach or see the mountain. Now, the mountain itself, Mount Kailash, it doesn't quite look like the other mountains.
No, it's isolated from the rest of the Himalayas, if by divine intent. There's a feeling about it that it's sort of been placed there, and I can understand why it was always considered holy, because it sits on its own, unlike, say, Everest, which climbs up on the shoulders of other mountains. This one is isolated beyond these very beautiful lakes, and from a distance it looks like a cone, really, like a sort of rocket that's about to take off. But when you get closer to it, you realize it's a pyramid. One of the strangest things is that all the four great rivers of the Indian subcontinent arise around that pyramid. The Brahmaputra, the Indus, the Sutlej, the northernmost source of the Ganges, or the highest source of the Ganges, they all rise within 70 miles of the summit of Mount Kailash. And that's one of the strangenesses. The other is that it is almost a perfect pyramid, and you look at the southern face, which is very beautiful, and appears to have a stairway on it. It's an odd geological formation. Looks like a place where spirits will ascend or descend. But as you go around it, and the pilgrims circle it clockwise, it becomes very austere. The western face seems to have great hammocks of snow slung against it, and it's pretty grim. And then you reach the northern face, which is appalling. It's a sheer 5,000-feet precipice dropping, ice-line precipice from the summit. And that's a very chilling sight.
Like it's a pyramid with a giant cut in it.
Yes, a huge cut with sort of hanging, strange hanging formations which almost overlap it like sort of porches. So the mountain's changing all the time. The formations around it are changing. And to Buddhist pilgrims in particular, every pinnacle and every sort of strange-shaped boulder or spur has a story to tell. It's the pinnacles of the habitation of gods, various subsidiary gods, probably, around the main peak. One of the interesting things about the tradition is that hermits are so highly regarded. I don't know any Asian tradition or any tradition at all in which these ascetics who sit in caves or did around Mount Kailash for years should be so revered. In the West, you know, we pretend to say, who are these useless old men going out there, sitting in caves, doing no good to anybody? The Tibetan perception of that is absolutely different. These people are praying for the sake of the world, for one thing, and to redeem karma, to increase the burden of good in the world as opposed to the good of the burden of evil. And those caves, they still believe, they still often know who contemplated there, who meditated, even though the hermit himself has died. The sanctity accruing to that cave, the power, they talk about the power a lot of that prayer, they believe still to be there in some way. So the mountain is filled with the past. It's filled with the energy that past hermits and prophets have given it. It's also filled with the footprints of saints. They'll point out everywhere the footprints of the Buddha or the footprints of various other sages who dwelt around the mountain. The effect of it is to steep the mountain in a kind of sanctity, which is, of course, invisible.
When you were there, you're walking into these caves as partly travel writer, but also partly pilgrim yourself. What were you actually feeling? Can you put it into words?
It's quite hard because I was going with a great interest, fascination really, with Tibetan Buddhism, but not with belief. I'm agnostic. I wasn't expecting, and it didn't happen, that this would be some sort of narrative of redemption or catharsis or illumination. It'd be a lovely thing to have written in the book that this had happened, but it didn't. I went in a spirit of some meditation, but not of any real feeling that I was going to be changed by either going round the mountain or entering these sanctuaries. I'm not changed, I mean, in some very fundamental and sudden way. I was going round with my dead family in mind. So experiences all around the mountain provoked memories of them. This happens, of course, if you're preoccupied by something, everything around you seems to reflect it back in some way or suggest it. There's not very much of it in the book. Perhaps one-tenth of the book is given to these sparks of memory or of sadness, but they carry a sort of incommensurate weight.
Well, I think that they're there partly because it's not just a physical journey. There's some kind of spiritual journey going on, even for you as an agnostic.
Yes, there is. There's a testing of my Christian heritage, if you like, a heritage which wishes to believe, of course, or does believe in the continuance of the individual, the soul, which we'd all love to believe that those we've loved exist, their memories are intact, their characters, even their appearance, that they can be met in an afterlife. And I was carrying this with me, not as a belief, but as part of a cultural desire. The Tibetans and Buddhists don't believe anything of the kind. Nothing is more natural to them that decaying minds and bodies should eventually pass away. What they're interested in is karma, which is the body of good and evil in the world, and whether with each incarnation that is made greater or less, and whether, in a way, the whole universe is moving towards enlightenment or whether it's not, whether an individual life is increasing that enlightenment or holding it back. It's a very different tradition, and the individual has no survival in it. As the Buddhists say, we have no belief in a god and no belief in a soul. Ours is not a religion in your sense of the word. Buddhists I knew in Kathmandu said it's like a science. It's a science, it's a discipline. A discipline of realization.
Were there a lot of people walking around the mountain while you did it? You mentioned that somebody actually swam in the holy water, and you, I think you said that you put your feet into
it. I waded tentatively in, but they believe that they go through a rite. These are the Hindus, not the Buddhists, in this lake, of what they call tapan, which is a rite which is supposed to ease the souls of your ancestors, of your family. And of course, this was touching to me. Even though, in fact, it contradicts much of official Hindu Buddhist belief, who believe that the living cannot help the dead. Yes, there were quite a few pilgrims going round the mountain. There always have been. Even when the Chinese banned pilgrimage here in the Cultural Revolution, they did it secretly at night. There are quite a few Westerners, Germans and Austrians in particular, who are trekkers, of course. They're doing it for the physical exercise. But the majority of the real pilgrims are Tibetan Buddhists who go around perhaps alone or just in a pair, go around very fast. It's 33 miles round the mountain, and these men and women and sometimes little children and babies are carried, and dogs going around with them. They'll do the whole thing in 36 hours with their tremendous lungs and their makeup, as if they're going around in the plateaus. The Hindus have a much harder time. They've come up from the Indian plains, and they're often middle-aged, modestly pious, unfit, and used to being at sea level in somewhere like Bangalore or Chennai. And suddenly they're taken up, many of them by rather unscrupulous Indian tour operators who don't give them health checks, don't tell them properly what is ahead of them, and they're shocked. They fly up maybe from Kathmandu to Lhasa, that's 8,000 feet. Then they truck across west from Lhasa to Mount Kailash, that's probably 4 days. They arrive at 15,000 feet in Kailash, and then they ascend the mountain another 3,500 feet. And these people are shocked at what's confronting them. They go in a tremendous spirit of piety, believing that this is going to give them a sort of redemption. It will absolve the sins of a lifetime just to walk around the mountain. But they die there. 8 of them died on the mountain when I was there of edema and heart failure. And they were simply not ready for it.
One of the more surprising elements in to a mountain in Tibet had nothing to do with the journey itself, but had to do with your research into the relationship of Tibetan Buddhism and Hinduism. All of these strange creatures that I saw on the walls of the Buddhist monasteries all through Thailand and that we see here, there's a serious one-on-one relationship with the Hindu religion, which reminded me a little bit of the relationship of the Greek and Roman gods.
Well, there's a sort of plurality of gods, both in Hinduism and in the Tibetan tradition. You know, officially, you read the philosophy and there's no god.
Right.
There's no soul. It's a practice. It's quite an ethical practice. It's concerned with abstracts very much. But you, just as in Hinduism, you go into Tibetan monasteries, particularly these funny little ones around Kailash, which are quite primitive, and there's a mass of gods confronting you. There's not just the Buddha of the future and the Buddha of the past, or the Maitreya, or the Amitabha, but there are all these other confusing gods. The goddess of compassion is there, and they're intertwined with one another sometimes in sexual embrace. And you're told when you start investigating them, who is this, who is that, but often they're aspects of one another. They're all interrelated in some way. You say, now, who is this goddess? You will ask somebody, and he will say, well, this goddess is the goddess Tara, the goddess of compassion, but she is actually an aspect or a variation on some other, perhaps male god. Or Durga is her equivalent in India, and so on. You find all the time that this strange congregation of gods which surround the little prayer hall in the monastery, if you were to ask a more pious and educated monk about them, they say they don't really exist. They are like figures on the way to Buddhist enlightenment. They help you along there, but they actually in themselves have no existence. Ordinary Tibetan pilgrims, they don't make the differentiation. You know, these are fairly simple people. They're farmers and herdsmen. They go around and they want something specific very often. They're not only gaining merit by going around for a future incarnation, but they want something for this world. You know, they want another yak.
They want a son. They want a better price for their butter. They want some success in gambling or sex or anything. And they will ask all sorts of things of the deities of the mountain as they go around. They may ask some of the fiercer mountain gods to kick out the Chinese and bring the Lama, Dalai Lama back. All sorts of things of a perfectly practical nature will be asked for, as well as the redemption of their sins. And it's a Buddhist tradition to dedicate their pilgrimage to those all sentient beings in the world, as they say, so that what they are doing is bringing merit, bringing benefit to all of us. It's in that way a very benign tradition and very unsectarian. It's rather grand.
At odd moments, you're talking to your guides. One of them, I think, has a daughter in America. You know, they're dealing on another level with the modern world. So even though you go back in time, you're not quite really going back in time. I'm sure there were some of those tourists with satellite phones going around the mountain.
Yeah, I'm not sure satellite phones work around the mountain. They may do, I doubt it. Yes, you find that the modern world has intruded. And certainly in these poor villages, what they've realized, particularly in Nepal, is that education matters. Education is the way out. You found this again and again, speaking to quite ordinary villagers. You know, some have said rather touchingly, it's too late for us, and we're not educated, we never will be, but maybe we can get our children into better schools. Maybe they can get into a charity school, you know, if they're Buddhist, down in the plains of Nepal, or even Dharamsala. The future has impinged itself in that way, that there is possibly a way out that they're looking for from extreme poverty that has been there always. These people, you look at their villages and they look charming. They're built of stone and timber on the Nepalese side. You think, well, life must be good here. It's so beautiful. But in fact, they just own a very narrow little field of barley or rice if they're lucky. And they often have to supplement their income by cutting down those beautiful forests around them and selling the timber over the border to a treeless Tibet. And that's the way some of them survive.
Colin Thuburn, you circle the mountain, and the book ends. Did you walk all the way back then to Sinakot? How'd you get home?
No, I got a Land Rover from close to Kailash, which took me for a couple of days east towards Lhasa, then down through the Himalayas to Kathmandu, a long, spectacular drive, which is, in a way, to Tibetans, it's sort of like leaving paradise. You're descending the Himalayas into the plains and leaving this strange world of gods and beliefs, and particularly for them, Mount Kailash, behind you.
And when you got back, at that point, you realized you wanted to create a book out of this?
I hadn't known whether there would be a book here, and I felt that, you know, maybe I'd write an article or two or something about it. And even after I got back, you know, I'd made notes, which is a sort of travel writer's habit. You just make notes. Because notes, they give you all the detail that you would normally forget. You can remember how a conversation normally went or what a bit of landscape looked like, but you don't remember the particular expression somebody used or the precise texture of that stone or the color. And those things have to go down in the notebooks. And so I came back with these notebooks, and I wasn't sure even then whether there was possibly a book here. I knew that memories of my family had been ignited by bits of the journey, but that wasn't, in terms of numbers of words, a great deal. And as I started to write it, I realized that there was a rather charged, strange book here in what I had in the notes. And then I started, in the tranquility of England, to write the book.
Had you considered maybe doing something fictional with it?
No. No, that didn't occur to me. I thought I'd just maybe do nothing with it, just have it there as a journey made for the rather pure reason of not for work at all, certainly not for gain, but just for remembrance and contemplation.
The travel writer, I guess, in you, because you'd written so much about travel, must have been, that little clock must have been going too.
Yeah, it does go. And even on holiday, you know, it's hard to tamp it down. All the time, it's maddening for my girlfriend. And when I'm on holiday, I sort of want to talk to people and find out what the political situation, what they're feeling about things, where their values are. You know, I always want to know where people place their their feelings of value and trust. That always fascinates me in a society, not really people's material benefit, but what they perhaps have faith in. And those things, even when I'm a holder, I'm sort of starting to ask people. And also to know about the history behind buildings or places or towns or societies. Always want to know the dates of things. And this is the way the travel writer's mind works. You can't let a building go by without having to locate it in time in some way. Yeah, I'm always doing this, and it takes a few days before I calm down and start becoming anybody remotely worth traveling with.
Is this one of the reasons why you became a travel writer, or did you kind of fall into it and it grew organically?
It's strange, those origins. I first loved words. That was what first, as quite a small boy, fascinated me. While other kids were singing or dancing or beating people up, I was making poetry. Awful poetry, dreadful, but, you know, celebrating the sort of butterflies that flew in my parents' garden, whatever it was, I had to put words to it. It seemed perfectly natural, the love of words. And then in my late teens, I became fascinated with travel, and I think it was partly that my father had been a diplomat and a soldier and had worked in Canada and the States just after the Second World War when I was a small child. And I went to school in England and had holidays in the States and Canada. And for a small boy out of war-torn London to be standing in Times Square, New York, or to be looking at the great landscapes of Canada, the great rivers and lakes, was an absolute revelation. And I think I never got over it. I think I went on feeling that abroad was exciting, home was rather boring. When I was in my late teens, the two things, the love of words and the love of travel, the excitement of the wider world, came together, and it seemed natural to be writing travel books.
And yet, at the same time, you're also a fiction writer. That kind of balances things a little bit for you?
Yes, I like it. I think if I had to write one travel book after another, I would wear very thin. I might not know where to go always. I don't like looking at a map and thinking, where shall I go next, as if I was going to have a pin and stick it in the map. I like to feel it's more something visceral, something that just comes and insists on itself and says, me, you've got to travel here, for no reason that you intellectually can work out. That's the ideal for me. And for that to happen, travel book after travel book after travel book, would be very unlikely. And it's wonderful to have the gap of writing fiction in between, because fiction minds are part of my sort of life that travel writing doesn't. The travel book about fascination with the outside world, the love of another culture, the desire to go there, the curiosity. Whereas fiction goes back inside myself, my personal life. That's where the novels spring from, which is a very different area that's left alone by travel writing. And the novels usually perhaps take a year and a half to write, not very long. And during that time, I probably become fascinated by some distant part of the world. And then I get sick of myself and the novel and get that out of the way. And off I go traveling again.
Today is March 16th, 2011. And we've both been following the events in Japan. First off, have you ever been to the part of Japan that was devastated? And as someone who travels the world and sees the world changing, given your age, what are your own thoughts regarding what we've been seeing over the past few days?
Japan, I know too little about. I was there years ago in the 1960s. I don't know the part that was specifically hit, but I think whenever you've been to a country, it has a different feel from a country that you haven't been to, however long ago and however slightly you went there. You put a human face to it. And it's not just this shape on a map. And Japan is, for me, still populated by people that I remember meeting there, places I remember seeing, landscapes that were beautiful, which I think in that part of the world they are, in that area where the earthquake was. A wider question you ask about the changing world. Yes, you do see it changing, and it's terribly easy to imagine it changing for the worse always. Travelers always bemoan that, you know, the world's become a suburb and that there's no travelling left to do, everything's been spoilt. It's not so. in the 1970s, I did a journey overland from England to India in the days that you could. And that meant going through eastern Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, northern Pakistan, Kashmir, countries that you would hesitate to travel in now. And in those days, the whole Soviet Union and China was virtually inaccessible to us. You could virtually not travel there except in very limited ways. So it seems to me that just as one part of the world is opening up, another's closing down. And so it's too easy an assumption to think that the world is becoming hopelessly westernized, hopelessly homogenized. Things are changing too much. I mean, you can read people who wrote 20, 40, umpteen years ago, and they're all going on about the same thing. Everything's getting worse. Young people are irresponsible and useless, and the old people are, were better, but are now decrepit. And so all these things, it's an everlasting human lament that things are getting worse. And certainly when travel writers are talked about, and people were lamenting the death of the travel and travel book years ago, Claude Lévi-Strauss, 50 years ago, was saying travel book's over, travel's finished, it's hopeless. And people before then, Joseph Conrad, the Polish novelist, saying in 1923, this is a game that's losing its interest, he said, the world's not worth travelling in. We seem condemned to thinking that our age is the last one that's of any use at all, and that the future is going to be worse. And certainly when I go back after 20 or 30 years to somewhere where I've been before, it's always on the tip of my tongue to say, oh, it was so much better earlier.
Colin Thubron, now the book has come out. Are you working on a novel? Are you planning another voyage?
A novel, but a novel that's so shadowy in my mind that I can't do any more about it.
You've been listening to an interview with Colin Thubron, whose latest book is To a Mountain in Tibet. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.